Welcome back, everyone. Happy birthday to Abraham Lincoln, who has to be part of the Mount Rushmore of presidents, right? Oh, wait, he's already on the Mount Rushmore of presidents, literally. Hey, Nick DeOlius here, and here is the far middle. Welcome to episode 195 in the middle of the month of February. Okay, our sports dedication this week is going to focus on the best at his specialized craft in the history of the game of baseball, and someone who passed away a relatively young age of 65 years at the very end of last year. A great player, but also a unique personality. I'm talking about Ricky Henderson. He was undersized, especially when you compare him to the big name players of today, but he definitely had an outsized branded image that was curated into the minds of baseball fans who watched and followed him. Those wraparound sunglasses, the way he would always refer to himself in the third person. And when I say always, I mean always. And one of his most effective tactics was his smaller compact size coupled with his crouched batting stance, created a really small strike zone. Every baseball fan has that visual of Ricky Henderson crouched into a little ball as he's awaiting a pitch. And that didn't serve or leave much of a strike zone for pitchers to work with. The great sports writer Jim Murray, he once described Henderson's strike zone as smaller than Hitler's heart. There's a great phrase from the great Jim Murray. And that's what helped Ricky Henderson get him on base, helped him draw walks, helped him get hits. But then it put him in a position once he was on base to steal bases and score. Now, speaking of hits and stolen bases, Ricky Henderson excelled at both. So statistically, he's clearly in legend status. He surpassed the magical 3,000 career hit mark, with only the smallest percentage of baseball greats being able to achieve that. But he also achieved even greater things beyond surpassing the 3,000 hit mark. Henderson also had power at the plate. He hit three homers shy of 300 home runs in his career at 297. Amazingly, 81 of those home runs were leadoff home runs for the game. And he is the sport's all-time leader in unintentional walks, accumulating 2,129 in his 25-year career. And of course, he is the all-time Major League Baseball record holder for stolen bases at 1,406. Most baseball historians consider him to be the greatest leadoff hitter of all time. His numbers that were just covered sort of prove that. He could get on base with a hit, he could be patient and take the walk to get on base, and then once on base, by either method, you know, he was sure to do something with regard to running the base paths or stealing bases. And what's even more impressive is considering that everybody in the stadium, they knew what Ricky's intentions were once he got on base. It wasn't a secret that he was going to attempt to steal, yet no one seemed able to stop him. I came across this stat around the time of his death that I posted on social media. He went 0-for-0 in a game because he walked four times. But in that game, he stole five bases and he scored four runs. That sums up the greatness of Ricky Henderson. And in today's game, he would have been even more of a threat to steal bases. The game today limits what pitchers can do in pickoff attempts and pickoff moves, and the bases are slightly bigger, which means that the distance to steal a base is a little bit shorter than when Ricky roamed the base paths. And that little bit of an advantage could make a huge difference when it came to what Ricky Henderson would have been able to do with that shorter distance. He played for a lot of teams over his 25-year career, I believe 9 total. Heck, he played for the Oakland A's over 4 different periods of time. Imagine that. And he was on base for the Blue Jays in the 1993 World Series when Joe Carter hit his epic home run to win the series for Toronto. And I said Ricky Henderson was a character. Here are two of my favorite Ricky Henderson stories, and there are many to choose from. First is the $1 million check that he received as a signing bonus from the A's. As Ricky put it, you know, when you're a kid, you want to be a millionaire. And at the time, I got a signing bonus for $1 million. I go, wow, I'm a millionaire. So I'm going to frame this here check. And I put it up on my wall when I became a millionaire. Now, that's what he did, literally. He didn't bother to sign and deposit the check. So the Oakland A's accounting team, they finally called him. And they asked, hey, Ricky, like, where's the check? And Ricky told him that it was hanging on his wall. So the A's asked him if he could take it down, go cash it, and then put a duplicate in the frame. He agreed, and the story is now legend. Okay, one more Ricky story. one with a biblical twist. Legend has it, one time somebody, maybe a teammate, quoted the Bible verse John 3:16 to Ricky Henderson. Ricky's response was, and remember, he always spoke in the third person, Ricky don't want to hear about John hitting 3:16. Ricky's hitting 3:30. In his Hall of Fame acceptance speech, here's what he said. When you think of me, I would like you to remember that kid from the inner city that played the game with all his heart and never took the game for granted. Hey, let's remember him that way. A belated rest in peace and far middle dedication to Ricky Henderson. Let's make a connection from the unique baseball great of Ricky to the unique literary great of Ayn. How about a dose of Ayn Rand insight? And I get a lot of inbound questions about how the far middle came to be, or maybe what I hope to achieve with it now that it's been up and running for almost 200 episodes. Came across something in a Rand essay recently that sort of speaks to the answers to those questions. And this was an essay of hers from the early 1960s, where I believe she was discussing the presidential election back then and her views of Republican candidate Barry Goldwater. What got my attention wasn't her views on Goldwater or that election, as interesting as they were. Instead, I was fascinated with her views on advocacy and on civil and civic discourse, things that are in the, I'll call it, mission DNA of the far middle. She pointed out that, quote, nothing is as futile as a movement without goals, or a crusade without ideals, or a battle without ammunition. A bad argument is worse than ineffectual. It lends credence to the arguments of your opponents. Half battle is worse than none. It does not end in mere defeat. It helps and hastens the victory of your enemies. Well put by Rand. And indeed, we share a duty, don't we, as Americans, to engage in public civil discourse. But to make it count the right way, we've got to be well prepared with our positions. Now, Rand went on in that essay to opine that it has been a long time since we have had a really good debate in the United States on the fundamentals of our society. A savage conflict between the parties on ideological grounds cannot be avoided now, but it can have some real advantages. Ideally, the purpose of an election is to clarify and not to confuse the issues, to destroy and not perpetuate illusion, to make a little clearer what we are and where we are. Now, as I said, that was from the early 1960s, and just think about how relevant it is today and how relevant it was during the 2024 presidential election. The more you read Rand, the more you respect her independent thinking ability, and I think some of her most insightful thoughts can be found in her essays and speeches, as opposed to her more popular platform of the fictional novel. Allow me to give you a current example of what Rand was talking about as our next connection. I'm going to use a recent news story in the Wall Street Journal by an elite reporter, and normally quite a good one in my opinion. And I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to unduly criticize him for a bad day or a single bad story. But there is an important illustration here that bears discussion. Now, this article talked about how President Trump's threats of tariffs on oil imports, how it might be a bad idea. And it uses some fairly common arguments and beliefs to make the case. Unfortunately, the logic in the story and the rationale that it applied, they were not well thought out. Using Rand's terminology, the story offered up a bad argument. Now, here's why. The first flaw in the story was positing that having Europe buy more U.S. energy, that might improve the specific balance of trade and energy, but that it wouldn't change the overall U.S. trade balance, and it might even make it worse. Well, that's nonsense, and any rational person that's got a basic understanding of economics knows that going from an energy importer to a net exporter position, it's one of the most effective ways for a nation to improve its balance of trade, whether it be to shrink its trade deficit or to grow its trade surplus. And it's shocking to see such a poor logic applied by an esteemed institution such as the Wall Street Journal in this instance. The second flaw in the story was pointing out that today the type of oil that can use or can be used and where you buy it, it has to do more with shipping costs and what type of crude a refinery is best designed to process, meaning the tariffs on oil imported to the United States or wanting Europe to buy more American energy may not fit well with the existing constraints of transportation logistics and refinery design. And that is true as things sit today. But the reason that is true is because once the radical environmental movement got a hold of American energy policy, the bureaucrat made it nearly impossible for new refineries to be built in the United States and for new transportation infrastructure to be constructed within the United States and globally, particularly with respect to things like oil and natural gas. Now, if government is now being seriously reformed and told to get out of the way of the private sector, then many of those existing bottlenecks that were created by regulation and policy driven by ideology, they're going to quickly be addressed as private investment flows to debottleneck current constraints. And that's going to allow American refiners and American energy producers much more flexibility and optionality with respect to utilizing domestic energy and exporting surplus domestic energy. Ignoring that reality, it borders on professional malpractice by the business journalist. There was a third flaw of the story, and I think this one was in some ways the most absurd and somewhat comical. It points out that even if the United States can sell Europe more natural gas, let's say, it may not want to, because in 2021, American industrial groups lobbied the Biden administration to keep natural gas here at home for their own use. Really? Yes, that was true. But what the journalist failed to mention was that those industrial groups were specifically the ones that buy American natural gas and thus are interested in keeping the price as low as possible and the supply as high as possible. It's their own self-interest that would never want to see any domestic natural gas being exported. But I can assure you that those very same companies and industrial groups, they would completely go berserk if the same thing was asked of them, to cease from any exporting activity for their product to keep the price of their product low domestically. So to proffer that as rationale is quite disingenuous. You know, I've had an increasing level of concern about bias and lack of rigor and logic that's found in today's business media, especially when it comes to the arena of energy and the arena of climate. This story in the Wall Street Journal provides, unfortunately, yet another example. I'm going to have much more to say about this beyond the podcast platform soon in 2025, so please stay tuned and I will definitely keep you informed. How about a connection from a great thought leader of the past, Ayn Rand, to a thought leader of today, and a dual connection from the malfeasance of the elite journalist writing in an elite newspaper that we just discussed to loss of confidence in elites by the American public. Read an essay by Kevin Roberts, who is the president of the Heritage Foundation. The title was Populist Conservatism and Constitutional Order. It's a quick but a fascinating read. He started out by pointing out that since the end of the Cold War, both Republican and Democratic administrations have cumulatively made America materially richer than we were in 1990, at least on paper, but that they've also made America weaker militarily and strategically, and also they've put us in very difficult, challenging fiscal sort of straits with our debt levels and deficits. And the value system of what it means to be American, that's been allowed to be vilified and ridiculed, which means that public trust in once respected institutions controlled by elites sitting at an all-time low. That holds true for political institutions, scientific ones, media, academia, and even religious institutions. Meanwhile, populism is on the rise, especially populism with a conservative flavor. Now, part of the reason for that is that the left has rejected populism and it now embraces big. Big what? Well, as Roberts put it in his essay, big government, big business, big banks, big tech, big pharma, big labor, big ag, big media, and big entertainment. The elite embracing big has failed America and Americans now for over 30 years. Our fiscal situation that I mentioned, that's a mess. Crises from the financial to the pandemic exposed ineptitude of the elite institutions. Think of just the COVID pandemic, where the government, through the bureaucrat and bolstered by the media, censored and demonized anybody that would dare question or challenge the official policies and tactics, even when those policies and tactics proved to be worse than useless and completely false. Government institutions have now been weaponized to engage in lawfare and partisan sniping, tit for tat. We surrendered secure borders, and the family, as a traditional unit, is facing some tenuous times. And oddly enough, all these inept moves brought to us by the left over the last three plus decades, and all of the organizations controlled by the left, all those bigs, so to speak, they're either funded by taxpayers or enabled by the bureaucracy that supposedly works for the taxpayers. So the path to reform is pretty self-evident. It's the citizens and taxpayers using the power of the purse and the power of the ballot box. And maybe we saw the start of that last year with the election. Time will tell if it's a legitimate chance to reform or if it's just a case of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. The Roberts piece had a quote from Gustav Mahler that says, "Tradition is not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire." That's been true since the Enlightenment, through the time of Ayn Rand, and true to our modern time of today. And that's why I publish The Far Middle, and I hope that's a reason why you tune in. As we wrap up episode 195, let's discuss an individual in the musical world who, like Rickey Henderson, was, or actually is, a great, and one that also offers quite the outsized personality. A while back, I wrote a piece that you can still access on nickdeolius.com. It's under the commentary section, that attempted to rank in order the 10 greatest rock guitarists of all time. And at the end of that essay, I also listed in no particular order the next 10 that just missed breaking my top 10. I received a lot of feedback, pun intended, on that piece. And one of the most popular questions within that feedback was how I could exclude Joe Walsh from that list. Certainly the extended top 10 that almost made the top 10 cut. Now that's a great question. Frankly, one that's bothered me since I published that piece. So as we conclude episode 195, I do want to spend a few minutes to pay homage to the great Joe Walsh. Most people associate Joe Walsh as being part of the Eagles, and that's understandable considering that the Eagles are one of the greatest groups in the history of rock and roll. Yet Joe Walsh achieved a lot of other notable accomplishments in his career besides the history he made with the Eagles. And to overlook those other accomplishments, that's a mistake. Back in 1968, he was the center of the James Gang, and then in the early 70s, he left the James Gang to form the group Barnstorm, which ultimately became just Joe Walsh. If you want the best feel for Joe Walsh outside of his work with the Eagles, I suggest you give his solo album, So What, a listen. It's just over 50 years old, and it would be best described as a country rock album. It was a big success for him at the time, and he enjoyed a lot of critical and peer praise. Now, who do I mean by peers? Well, Pete Townsend and Jimmy Page, they love the album and they love Joe Walsh. And Eric Clapton said of Walsh, "He's one of the best guitarists to surface in some time. I don't listen to many records, but I listen to his." Joe Walsh had serious expectations for that album that became So What. Before it was released, he told Rolling Stone that he wanted the record to be the difference between Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, referring to the evolution the Beatles enjoyed, that jump between those two albums. And by the way, Joe Walsh's brother-in-law is none other than Ringo Starr. Ringo and Joe are married to the Box sisters. But back to that album of So What. Like much art that became great, this album was impacted by personal tragedy. His wife at the time was driving their two-year-old daughter to school in Boulder, Colorado, where they lived, when her vehicle was hit by another car, and their two-year-old daughter died from injuries sustained in that accident, a true tragedy. And much of that obvious pain that he went through with that loss, you can find it in songs on So What. Falling Down and Help Me Through the Night were two of the most notable examples. There's also Song for Emma, which was the name of his daughter. And for another side note, the song Falling Down, that was co-written with Walsh by Don Henley, which would become, of course, his future bandmate in the Eagles. Glenn Frey of the Eagles also appears on this album. In fact, Joe Walsh urged his producer at the time to produce the Eagles albums. And with all those interconnections, it's not surprising that Joe Walsh eventually ended up as a member of the Eagles. So be like Eric Clapton and give So What by Joe Walsh a listen if you get a chance in the coming days. Try to put yourself in his frame of mind considering the pain he was in when he made that record due to the loss of his daughter. It's my favorite album from the eccentric and lovable Walsh. What's my favorite Joe Walsh song? Well, as a solo act, I'm going to go with In the City. And as part of the Eagles, where he sang lead, I'm going to go with Pretty Maids All in a Row. What's your faves from Walsh? And while you ponder that question, I can tell you what Joe Walsh's favorite song of his solo catalog is. He's gone on record, pun intended again, saying that Rocky Mountain Way was the best song that he wrote. He came to the lyrics while cutting his grass in Colorado and looking up at those snow-covered mountains on a nice warm day. And he went in the house and he wrote the lyrics, tying them to his career switch from the James Gang to a solo act. That's where the line of the Rocky Mountain Way is better than the way we had. That's where it came from. He's talking about going from the James Gang to solo. Oh, and back to the impact and influence of Joe Walsh. Here's a cool few antidotes. In 1969, he insisted that Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page switch to a Gibson Les Paul standard, and he sold Jimmy Page his own 1959 model. Now, that guitar would become Jimmy Page's go-to, and it formed the core for what became the signature sound of Led Zeppelin. And then in 1970, Joe Walsh gave Pete Townsend of The Who an Orange Gresh guitar and a Fender amp. Townsend used that combination on Who's Next and Quadrophenia to produce that new heavy sound of The Who. And for those of you that have been constant listeners of this podcast long enough, you might recall that my favorite Who album of all time is Quadrophenia. My favorite Led Zeppelin album, by the way, is Physical Graffiti, which are interesting because both Quadrophenia and Physical Graffiti, they're double albums. So maybe that's cheating to say that they were my favorite albums from those groups. Hey, that's it for this episode, folks. Until next week, always stay connected to that far middle.